I'll begin by telling you that the Matthew passage is one of those lectionary weeks I normally choose to focus on the Deuteronomy passage instead, because that's also very rich. I tend to steer clear of the Matthew passage from today because, well, it's complicated. Here we see a bit of the judgy side of Jesus, a Jesus whom people don't often want to cozy up to. I also know that so many in our congregation have relationships that are, well, complicated. Some have divorced, some have never married, and I know a few of you are happy and whole as single people. And to be quite honest, I'm not sure how many of you may have been in relationships that have been touched by infidelity, so I don't even know how closely any of these words come to any of you. I also remember being a kid and listening in church with my head resting on my mom's shoulder. We would always sit up in the church balcony, and I used to think we sat there because it was where parents with squirmy kids could sit without worrying about the impact their kids would have on the rest of the congregation. My church growing up was much more formal than this child-loving congregation. I remember the booming of the Schlichter organ, since its most impressive pipes were up there in the balcony. And when our minister of music really let loose on the organ, the sound would echo through my chest cavity and vibrate through my shoes and seat as much as it thundered in my ears. But as an adult, I recognize now that the real reason my mom sat in the church balcony is because my dad, who had divorced her when I was two, sat down in the main level with his wife, my stepmom, and with my grandparents. It was complicated, yet still, their thirst for God was strong enough that they found ways to be in church together, even when they weren't together. And for that, I'm grateful. I also remember a sermon my pastor at that church preached on marriage. He spoke about how wrong divorce is and how children of divorce are more likely to have serious problems than children from a stable family. At that point, I knew my mom hadn't chosen divorce for herself, and with my head resting on her shoulder, I wondered how much she felt the burden of how I might turn out. I remember wanting her to believe that what she could give me would be enough, and wanting to turn okay for her. But I did not yet have the kinds of words to tell her something like that. So yeah, marriage is complicated, which is why I wanted to push into what Jesus said about marriage in this gospel passage, and why I was bold enough to put a sermon on marriage on the church sign. During the week, I had a few people from the community comment on the sign saying, "Oh, so you're preaching a sermon on marriage tomorrow? Well, good luck with that." Let me first offer this disclaimer. Although I am married, I don't pretend to be an expert on marriage. I'm learning as I go along, and sometimes I'm better at it, and sometimes I'm worse. But I do know that we, have made a choice for marriage at a time when there was not so much support for it in family or in society. Chris and I became engaged before it was even legal for a same-sex couple to be married. Ours would be the first same-sex wedding in the church that I pastored at the time, and the leadership suggested we call it a commitment ceremony. But Chris and I argued for the language of marriage because even though it would not yet be legally recognized, even though 4 years later when it became legal we married again, marriage was the language of how we wanted our relationship to be defined before God, before a community, and before each other. When Chris told her parents we were engaged, it took a while for the meaning to sink in. And in fact, on a trip to Italy, Chris's mom made a wish in the Trevi Fountain, a place that supposedly grants any wish made there, that Chris and I not get married. On her plane ride home from Italy, when they landed at JFK, a man in a rush to get his suitcase down, pulled loose a piece of airline equipment from the overhead baggage. It tumbled down, hitting Chris's mom in the head and knocking her out into the aisle, sending her straight to the hospital. When she recovered, she told her older daughter, Chris's sister, "I have done a terrible thing. Here is how God is punishing me. I prayed at the Trevi Fountain that Chris not get married to Leah. God is trying to show me how wrong I am." We just let it stand there at that. So needless to say, from the moment we decided to get married to our decisions whether, when, and how to have a child, to decisions on how we fit our marriage into the pressures of two demanding careers, we have often had to be intentional in how we present and sometimes even fight for our marriage. Being able to take marriage for granted seems like a luxury we haven't fully known. And maybe from that angle, it's a good thing, because there is little expectation or formula for what a marriage like ours should look like. And we have been able to negotiate and define our expectations for ourselves and one another, mostly free of gender roles, in terms of how we share money, intimacy, faith, parenting, and depending on who you ask, perhaps the least sexy of all, household chores. There are some of these topics that can make or break couples. And when I perform a wedding ceremony, I invite couples into my office to talk about how they will share these aspects of their lives together. We talk about how to cultivate trust in the face of vulnerability, how to communicate, and how to nurture respect and admiration in each other, and how to have enough faith in one another to reconcile when they fail each other, because they certainly will fail each other. Last Tuesday, I got a call from a man who was looking to marry his fiance. He wondered if I could officiate 3 days later so that they could get married on Valentine's Day. So romantic. The courthouse, he told me, was already booked for the day, so he thought he'd try me. Now, I know some people, my sister included, have successful marriages that began as an elopement. But as a pastor, I consider my part in helping a couple start their marriage is providing a space to talk about these different aspects of married life so that the couple has a template for communication when these issues arise in the future, and they will. So, no Cupid's arrow from this pastor this week. I kindly suggested that they call a professional wedding officiant instead. My cousin's pastor in Georgia, several years ago, challenged all the married couples in their congregation to have sex every day for an entire month. You could tell from the glow on my cousin and her husband's faces with each Facebook post that they made that month what they had been up to. If as a couple you want to do that, good, go for it. Give it a try, have fun. And speak to Karen, our worship chair, so that she can keep the baptismal font full. And if you do not want to take the 30-day challenge, fine. That's your right, too. While I affirm that sex is important in marriage, I would not oversimplify marriage to say that the recipe to marital bliss is to just get jiggy with it. And if you're single and trying to figure out what level of intimacy is right for you, that's an important journey as well. And I don't want you to feel ignored. Married, single, divorced, or widowed, no matter who you are worthy of giving and receiving love because God loved you first. Sexuality is a gift from God meant to be honored and enjoyed, treasured and reawakened, always to be shared with mutual respect. Although we don't know anything about Jesus' sex life or romantic life, we do know he recognized how powerful sexuality is. He's the one who stopped an entire crowd from stoning a woman who had been caught in adultery, saying, "You who are without sin may cast the first stone." In that instant, as hands released and rocks tumbled to the ground, Jesus showed compassion. Yet in our lectionary reading today, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Why would Jesus say this? Surely he knew that every listener among them, maybe even Jesus himself, had looked at someone with lust. For most of us, it's in our hormonal wiring. We cannot help but notice beauty, attraction, and even desire. They say that February and March is a high mating season for skunks. Have you smelled it? In Leonia, you can catch a whiff of their perfumes if you walk outside at night. Last week, one skunk, a lovesick Romeo, lost its life chasing tail while crossing Fort Lee Road. Its essence remains all the next day and night, a reminder of how our bodies are similarly fashioned. We are driven to crave one another, even in our advanced capacity for language and reasoning. We may be able to talk ourselves out of it, and mostly we are able to talk ourselves out of catastrophic liaisons, even if we may dream of them. But according to Jesus, it looks like even those dreams may be forbidden fruit. He takes intention and commitment and takes it to a whole new level in a series of formulas. "You have heard it said," followed by, "But I say to you." Jesus asks us to move from what the bare minimum of tradition, of what tradition requires, or what the law requires, or what decency requires, to what might be more generous, more life-giving, and more like God. For example, Jesus said, "You have heard it was said of ancient times, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Whoever murders shall be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment." Everyone listening would have known that the Ten Commandments require that we not kill one another. But Jesus' point is that if not murdering is a guiding baseline for a relationship, then we really have no hope for a community. It's got to be something more. And so Jesus pushes us to examine our anger and find ways toward being reconciled with one another. Likewise, regarding marriage, there are things the law says. Divorce was allowed in Jesus' time, but the Jewish laws on divorce favored the rights and autonomy of the man. He could divorce her for whatever reason he wants. In Deuteronomy 24, it simply says that he may find something objectionable about her. And he has to write a certificate of divorce, and then he can be done with the marriage. Women were not given the right to initiate a divorce, but if a man divorced a woman, she was left in economic, social, and physical vulnerability. In this way, Jesus' teaching about divorce was just as compassionate as him stepping in to keep an adulterous woman from being stoned. When Jesus speaks about adultery, another behavior which, like murder, is forbidden by the Ten Commandments, Jesus not only condemns adultery, but also the participation of the eyes that gaze with longing, the hands that reach to touch another outside the bounds of covenanted love. "If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away." Who among us, especially in this modern hyper-visual age, would not be blind if we actually did what Jesus asked of us? But in moving beyond the bare minimum of what the law asks of our marriages and relationships, Jesus tells us that refraining from sleeping with each other's spouses is just the barest foundation of Christ-centered community. What about honoring human dignity by refusing in any way to cheapen or objectify other people for our own pleasure? What about helping each other to succeed in our marriages and other relational commitments instead of making those vows even harder to fulfill? I took a literary criticism class in college with a notoriously difficult professor. When he gave our writing assignments, someone in the class asked, "How many pages do our papers need to be?" The student wanted to know the minimum expectation she had to accomplish to get a good grade. His answer surprised us all, who were experts at adding filler and changing fonts to get the right sized paper. He told us, "Doesn't matter how long your paper is, as long as it is made of finely spun gold." In a similar way, Jesus redirects us from the letter of the law in regards to our relationships, and he reforms our understanding into the spirit of the law. Instead of doing the bare minimum word count of our assigned interactions, Jesus calls us into something deeper. "See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live." God told the Hebrews this in Deuteronomy. This is not a speech given for one person or even one marriage. It was given to a community, surely made of married and single and widowed and divorced folks, calling them to muster forth enough faithfulness together to make this enterprise with God actually work. Our loving relationships probably don't always look like finely spun gold. But if we invite them into God's calling toward the fullness of life, perhaps we can offer something more than the minimum requirement. And at times, we may even strike the chords in our love relationships that will also call forth God's love for us in ways that echo through the chest cavity and vibrate through our shoes and seats and as much as it thunders in our ears. For better or for worse, whether we find love through our friendships and community or family or spouses, God created us for love because God first loved us so dearly. We are the instruments of that love for one another, and we are worthy enough to give and receive love.